content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, a team of volunteer readers will be reading short science fiction stories. We call our program Science Fiction Shorts, and it will be available in podcast after the broadcast.
I'm Joe Campo. This is Metal and Flesh by Marie Vibert. Organic Unit 12 was having trouble using stairs. I took it to the service techs, but there wasn't anything they could do. Flesh isn't like steel, Raj, they said. There's only so much we can reconstruct. They picked up some messy bits of a human they'd just worked on. The parts aren't interchangeable. Sizes are all different. Some of them, even the same size, aren't compatible. You replace an organ and it swells up and falls off. If the knee is still working at all, I say leave it. I liked Unit 12, and I hated watching its discomfort. Well, couldn't you just replace the organic knees with steel ones? The tech dropped the mess of parts and shook the blood off its hand. Don't be sick, Raj. But no. Put metal parts on an organic? They'd start thinking they were like us. Where would it end? I could tell the service techs were not going to even consider it. So I thanked them and led Unit 12 to the door. 12 was slow to move, transfixed by the table of removed parts. I hoped it wasn't a sign of the stair-climbing problem worsening. Another organic unit, 5, had a metal carapace. 5 hadn't had it when I first acquired it, but it had it now, and it was undoubtedly metal. As soon as I returned to the work floor, I found 5 on the furnace crew. Where did you get that carapace? None of your damn business. It deftly avoided my grip and tried to rejoin the work crew. I stopped it by stepping in its way. It's important, 5. I need replacement parts for number 12. Now, where did you get that? Jack doesn't need replacement parts. He needs to retire. I don't want to retire 12. Once organic units are retired, they don't come back. 5 grew quiet and avoided looking at me. That's not what I meant by retire. My unit director often said that there was no point trying to talk to humans. It wasn't alone in those opinions, and I could see why. Really. But I didn't have budget to get more organic units, and 12 was my best fine tool unit. Explain what you meant, I said. When we get old, 5 said, we need rest. Time not working. But I don't want to retire Unit 12. Forget it. You'll never understand. You assholes won't even learn our genders. Can I go back to slaving now? I gripped the metal carapace where it came out of the flesh of 5's body, in front of and below the shoulder joint. Who made this? I made it, 5 said. This is a metal shop. You should know that since you run it. My metal and tools were used to fashion this? Take it out of my non-paycheck. I am not angry. Can you make knees for Unit 12? No, it said, and looked apologetic, at least. We had people once who could make metal knees. We called them doctors, and they worked in buildings called hospitals, and it was all pretty damn impressive. You'd know that if you stopped and looked before destroying everything. I don't want to retire Unit 12, I repeated. Unit 5 ducked its head. I can make a brace, it said. Braces for his knees. but you'll need to get me some fabric and rubber. I will do this, I said, and let go of Five's carapace. Asshole, it said, and went back to the furnace crew. After I collected the materials, Unit 5 also requested a clean place to work, so I set it up in my office. It took off its metal carapace, setting it by the door, and started sorting through the materials. This can work, it said. I made some splints. It produced four narrow strips of metal from a pocket on its clothing. Why did you make the carapace? I asked. It laid the strips of metal against the fabric and turned the fabric on my desk. It protects me in the cutting room and when feeding the furnace, it said. The other guys thought I was nuts, but now they're all jealous. I'm the only one in the crew with two intact nipples. Unit 5 measured the fabric with its flattened hand. Before all this, I had a thing for medieval armor. I was what you call a reenactor. I made the cuirasses like that for other people to fight in and gave lectures on evidence that women could be blacksmiths. I do not understand. No, you wouldn't. Five stitched the cloth with a single thread in the human way. I had always wondered why the organics didn't just wear the covers we manufactured for them. Our machines use thread more efficiently by weaving it into shape. But of course, organics were not properly uniform in size, so a customization process was necessary. I was pleased with my deduction and considered writing a report. It was disquieting and yet calming, watching Five's motions so close to even, but not. Thank you, I said, for extending the usefulness of Unit 12. Call him Jack, it said. If you're grateful at all, give me that. My superiors had warned against giving the organics names. It made them seem too much like people. But I supposed, in private, there was no harm. All right, I will. How long will the brace enable Jack to use the stairs? Don't know. We'll have to see. It would help if you put a railing up.
A railing?
A bar along the stairs for us to put our hands on. Helps with balance.
Ah, could you draw specifications for this device?
Unit 5 tucked the needle into the fabric and gestured at the ceiling. It's a bar. You just... It sighed and spoke as though I had raised an objection. Yeah, I'll draw it. It resumed its work. My name's Shantae, by the way, since you asked.
I didn't ask.
I know. I'm trying to be funny. Also trying to make friends. Maybe that'll save the human race.
You need saving? From what?
Shantae concentrated on its work. After a while, it said, "Bring Jack in. This is ready to try on." I gratefully did and observed the tender way the humans interacted with each other. I wondered if they were bonded through one of their many biological functions.
"That feels good," said Jack. It flexed its knees. "Real good."
Playing all the sports I did, I learned my way around a knee brace, Shantae said. "Try it on some stairs." Jack walked up and down the stairs to the lab. It moved like it hadn't in years, though it was still slower coming back down than going up.
"Thank you. Return to work. I will take these prototypes to the central office," I said, "and have many more created."
The organic units looked sullen. "How about I make a second pair," Shantae said. "Or you could let me look for some out in the world. Gotta be the ruins of a sporting goods store out near the highway."
"I can't let organic units out of the workshop," I said. "But if there are sufficient materials here, you may construct a duplicate pair of braces, if it doesn't extend much further into your work period."
Half kind is twice cruel, Shantae said. I took that to mean my organic units were not as fond of me as I was of them.
I will count your efforts on the braces as work time, I said, and I will craft the stair railing, Shantae.
Shantae put her hand on my metal chest. It left an oily print. I put my hand on her soft chest. Something in her expression changed, and she nodded.
I really was growing fond of my organic units. I didn't want to retire any of them. But, of course, I would have to choose some of the less productive ones to retire soon. Or I would have nothing to feed the rest.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Oceans of You by Pam L. Wallace. You laughed when you scooped up something from the beach. You brushed off the sand, then offered it in cupped hands. A rock, perfectly heart-shaped, except for a chip on the left side that gave it a lopsided appearance, just like your smile. Here's my heart, you said. It had been 3 weeks, 4 days, 7.5 hours since we met. A lifetime, a second, forever. I took your heart. You pulled me into your arms, fiercely tender. The waves crashed in an iridescent green sheet, rushing to coat our feet with icy froth. And I drowned in the deep ocean blue of your eyes. You laughed when you pulled me out on the deck, pointing at the stars, your eyes alight with reflected moonlight as you told me about the mission. You were alive with excitement, gleeful at the prospect of traveling beyond our solar system, discovering new worlds, being the first. I was happy for you until I understood what it meant for us. I wanted you to stay. No, what I really wanted was for you to want to stay. I understood then that I'd never mean as much to you as the stars. Oh, I knew you loved me, but you'd love space and science and exploration your entire life, and me only the last year. You sobered when you saw my sadness, talked about the time we still had, all the things we would do, and I drowned in a tidal wave of longing. You laughed when I told you I was pregnant. For a moment, I glimpsed that look in your eyes, the one you usually reserved for the stars, and this time, it was when you were looking at me. I basked in that glow, in the feeling of complete and utter joy. Your arms around me, one hand resting on the curve of my belly. Contentment settled around me and stayed all through the pregnancy. Even though your training kept you away for long hours, it was enough that you came home with that look in your eyes, directed at me, at my growing bump, even when my belly button distended. The baby's nubbin, you called it, and you laughed. The baby came, and I saw the look in your eyes, directed into a smaller pair of deep ocean blue eyes. We named him Jason, after his grandfather, and I drowned in a warm sea of contentment. You laughed when you told me all systems were go and the mission was approved. Your excitement was tempered by what it would mean for me and Jason. When you found me crying in the bedroom, you held me so tenderly. You told me you'd stay. For me. For Jason. I knew it wasn't what you wanted. But I didn't care. I needed you beside me. For Jason. No, for me. When I said yes, stay, I watched your laughter fade, leaving your eyes a deep, dark well. I saw you looking out the window at the stars, and for the first time, your look was filled with sorrow and regret, and I drowned in waves of guilt. You laughed, subdued and quiet, at Jason's toddling, but your spark was gone. There was no joy hidden in your dark depths. You became more and more withdrawn, sneaking away to peer out the windows at the night sky, lost in dreams that didn't include me, and never had. I knew it, I really did. I didn't want to believe it. I wanted to believe that someday you'd love me more than the stars. I thought that by denying the stars to you, it would force you to see me instead. I finally realized it was only forcing you to accept second best. And that's when I told you to go. You did, with one last look of regret, running straight down to Mission Command to see if it wasn't too late. And it wasn't. Not for you. But for me and Jason, it had always been too late. I held you for every second I could, committing your face to pictures and memory, forgetting that I would soon be alone, and just rejoicing in being us, together for now. And I drowned, over and over again, in the deep, dark ocean blue of your eyes. You laughed when you left that day for the launch test. You stepped out the door, jaunty and at ease, and I waved and laughed back, forgetting myself, and just happy that you were so happy. I had finally accepted the inevitable. We still had time. I refused to count the days or the hours, living in the now. Each minute with you was my eternity. It was a good day. Jason gurgled his joy in discovering how to climb into the toy box. He clapped his hands together when the doorbell rang, toddled over to the door to gaze, wide-eyed, at the uniformed officers. I closed the door in their face, as if that could hold back the news forever, and I drowned in dark seas of despair. I heard your laughter at liftoff. The behemoth blasted upward in a shock of white vapor, and I heard you so clear, booming through the crackle of the loudspeaker, in the collective sigh from the viewers in the stands. Your wish was granted. The ashes, all that is left of you, on board the ship, destined to forever reside on alien soil, so far away from me. And yet, you'll always be near. I see you everywhere, and especially in the deep, dark ocean blue of our sun's eyes. Your laughter is always with me, and I drown in it. Over and over again.
I am Sonia Usach-Kuhn, and I will be reading My Ribs, A Cage by Marissa Harwood. For 30 solid seconds, I stood frozen. I did not breathe. I wouldn't be surprised if my heart neglected to beat. I felt the comforting presence of the other realities pressing at the back of my mind, but I pushed them away. A strange sensation filled me, cold flicking down from my brain into my extremities like raindrops sliding down a window pane. Then gasping, great swallows of air, a burst in my chest, no, a supernova in my chest, my ribs a cage that couldn't hold the pieces together. Like a pebble into a rapid, a thought dropped into my mind. This is what my heart feels like when it's truly breaking. His blood covered the kitchen floor. It stole across the linoleum and into my shoes. My toes were sticky with it. I calmed my breathing and pulled together the last 3 minutes of my life. We'd argued about what I could no longer remember, and then his hand had darted to the drawer, the one in the far corner of the kitchen that didn't open all the way. And when it emerged, it held a gun, his intruder gun, his just-in-case gun, and that alien hand pressed the muzzle against his temple, and in my righteous anger I scoffed and said, "You wouldn't dare." And then he proved me wrong. The heater kicked on. I stared at a fleck of his skull stuck to the greasy wall. Yes, I thought, this is what my heart feels like when it's truly breaking. I stood there for a moment and let the pain seep into every cell. Then I closed my eyes and forced my consciousness out of my body. I flipped through the layers of realities until I found the fabric of time stretched out over the bloody kitchen like a grid. It flowed steadily away from me. It only took a quick tug, a brief interlocking of my will with the threads that held together the universe to drag the grid toward me. 30 seconds, 1 minute, 90 seconds, 2 minutes. I heaved a sigh and dropped back into myself. When I opened my eyes again, he stood in the corner of the kitchen, muzzle to his temple, chest rising and falling in angry desperation. I held up my hands, took a step. "No, baby," I said, my voice soft in the charged space between us. "No, don't." He stared at me a moment. I watched a grief creep into his eyes, a grief so palpable, it was no wonder they watered. He lowered the gun. "I knew you'd stop me," he said, voice rasping through his teeth. "I knew it." My heart slammed against its cage, darkness coiled around the edges of my vision. "Of course." I stopped, swallowed, started again. "Of course, I did."
This is Steve Lord, and I'm reading Storytime by Laura Ann Gilman. There was a prince who lived in a broken-down castle in a broken-down land. He had no great treasures, no great armies, no great love to save him, and neither did his land. And he cursed the skies and the streams each day that had cast him to be born to this life, to be born to the poverty. How could he be a prince if he was poor? Running a country is very expensive. Didn't he have a fairy godmother or a dragon to bring him money? He did not.
He needs a dragon.
Does he now?
He needs a dragon and a love, because you can't just have money, you gotta have love too.
You are very wise for one so very young. The youngling made a face, nose scrunched up.
Tell me more about the poor prince.
Yes?
Please?
The prince did not wish to be a prince. It may be that he wanted to be a dragon himself, to spread great wings and fly off, to bring back treasures and perhaps a fair maiden who might come to love him.
Or eat.
Or eat, although that would only stave off his hunger for a little while.
But he wasn't a dragon, not even a little bit?
Not even a little bit.
So what happened to the prince?
Nothing happened. He stayed where he was and cursed the skies and streams and did the best he could. He fought off famine and foes, spread himself as thin as he could, but it wasn't enough. And slowly his people starved and died.
That's not a story.
It's not?
It's not a good story.
No, perhaps it is not. How would you make it better?
He could ride off and have adventure and find a fortune.
And then who would take care of his people while he was gone?
Oh.
The youngling made another face, knuckles cracking.
Adventure could come to him. With the fairy godmother who had missed his birth and wanted to make it up to him, with a big party and presents, so he'd not be poor ever again.
That would be a good story.
But it doesn't have a dragon.
No, it doesn't.
I would be his dragon.
Would you now? And what would you do if you were his dragon?
Bring him my hoard, if I had one, that is.
Knuckles dragged across a worn, scraped floor. And if you did not?
I'd find one and bring it to him, so he wouldn't have to curse any more, but could be happy and not worry about his people any more, and he could go have adventures then. That would be a proper story.
They were silent a moment, contemplating adventure.
And I'd find a love for him, too, a princess, or another prince, or a coal girl. Princes fall in love with coal girls, don't they?
Perhaps they do.
Do they ever fall in love with dragons?
Sometimes, in the very best stories, they do.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Science Fiction Shorts. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.